The Tragedy at Brookbend Cottage by Ernest Brahma. Part 2. It was more than a week after his introduction to Carrados that Lieutenant Hollier had a summons to present himself at the turrets again. He found Mr. Carlyle already there, and the two friends were awaiting his arrival.
"I stayed in all day after hearing from you this morning, Mr. Carrados," he said, shaking hands. "When I got your second message, I was all ready to walk straight out of the house. That's how I did it in the time. I hope everything is all right."
"Excellent," replied Carrados. "You'd better have something before we start. We probably have a long and perhaps an exciting night before us."
"And certainly a wet one," assented the lieutenant. "It was thundering over Malling Way as I came along."
"That is why you are here," said his host. "We are waiting for a certain message before we start, and in the meantime you may as well understand what we expect to happen. As you saw, there is a thunderstorm coming on. The Meteorological Office morning forecast predicted it for the whole of London, if the conditions remained. That is why I kept you in readiness. Within an hour it is now inevitable that we shall experience a deluge. Here and there, damage will be done to trees and buildings. Here and there, a person will probably be struck and killed."
"Yes."
"It is Mr. Creek's intention that his wife should be among the victims."
"I don't exactly follow," said Hollier, looking from one man to the other. "I quite admit that Creek would be immensely relieved if such a thing did happen, but the chance is surely an absurdly remote one."
"Yet, unless we intervene, it is precisely what a coroner's jury will decide has happened. Do you know whether your brother-in-law has any practical knowledge of electricity, Mr. Hollier?"
"I cannot say. He was so reserved, and we really knew so little of him."
"Yet in 1896, an Austin Creek contributed an article on alternating currents to the American Scientific World. That would argue a fairly intimate acquaintanceship."
"But do you mean he is going to direct a flash of lightning?"
"Only into the minds of the doctor who conducts the post-mortem and the coroner. This storm, the opportunity for which he has been waiting for weeks, is merely the cloak to his act. The weapon which he has planned to use, scarcely less powerful than lightning, but much more tractable, is the high-voltage current of electricity that flows along the tram wire at his gate."
"Oh!"
exclaimed Lieutenant Hollier, as the sudden revelation struck him. "Sometime between 11 o'clock tonight, about the hour when your sister goes to bed, and 1:30 in the morning, the time up to which he can rely on the current, Creek will throw a stone up at the balcony window. Most of his preparation has long been made. It only remains for him to connect up a short length to the window handle and a longer one to the other end to tap the live wire. That done, he will wake his wife in the way I have said. The moment she moves the catch of the window, and he has carefully filed its parts to ensure perfect contact, she will be electrocuted as effectually as if she sat in the executioner's chair in Sing Sing prison."
"But what are we doing here?"
exclaimed Hollier, starting to his feet, pale and horrified.
"It is past 10 now, and anything might happen."
"Quite natural, Mr. Hollier," said Carrados reassuringly. "But you need have no anxiety. Creek is being watched. The house is being watched. And your sister is as safe as if she slept tonight in Windsor Castle. Be assured that whatever happens, he will not be allowed to complete his scheme, but it is desirable to let him implicate himself to the fullest limit. Your brother-in-law, Mr. Hollier, is a man with a peculiar capacity for taking pains."
"He is a damned cold-blooded scoundrel," exclaimed the young officer fiercely. "When I think of Millicent 5 years ago..."
"Well, for that matter, an enlightened nation has decided that electrocution is the most humane way of removing its superfluous citizens,"
suggested Carados mildly. "He is certainly an ingenious-minded gentleman. It is his misfortune that in Mr. Carlyle he was fated to be opposed by an even subtler brain."
"No, really, Max,"
protested the embarrassed gentleman. "Mr. Hollier will be able to judge for himself when I tell him that it was Mr. Carlyle who first drew attention to the significance of the abandoned kite," insisted Carados firmly. "Then, of course, its object became plain to me, as indeed to anyone. For 10 minutes, perhaps, a wire must be carried from the overhead line to the chestnut tree. Creek has everything in his favor, but it is just within possibility that the driver of an inopportune train might notice the appendage."
"What of that?"
"Why, for more than a week he has seen a derelict kite with its yards of trailing string hanging in the tree."
"A very calculating mind, Mr. Hollier.
It would be interesting to know what line of action Mr. Creek has mapped out for himself afterwards. I expect he has half a dozen artistic little touches up his sleeve. Possibly he would merely singe his wife's hair, burn her feet with a red-hot poker, shiver the glass of the French window, and be content with that, to let well alone. You see, lightning is so varied in its effects that whatever he did or did not do would be right. He is in the impregnable position of the body showing all the symptoms of death by lightning shock, and nothing else but lightning to account for it. A dilated eye, heart contracted in systole, bloodless lungs shrunk to a third the normal weight, and all the rest of it. When he has removed a few outward traces of his work, Creek might quite safely discover his dead wife and rush off for the nearest doctor. Or he may have decided to arrange a convincing alibi and creep away, leaving the discovery to another. We shall never know. He will make no confession."
"I wish it were well over," admitted Hollier. "I'm not particularly jumpy, but this gives me a touch of the creeps."
3 more hours at the worst, Lieutenant," said Carados cheerfully.
"Aha! Something is coming through now."
He went to the telephone and received a message from one quarter, then made another connection and talked for a few minutes with someone else.
"Everything working smoothly," he remarked between times over his shoulder. "Your sister has gone to bed, Mr. Hollier."
Then he returned to the house telephone and distributed his orders.
"So we," he concluded, "must get up."
By the time they were ready, a large closed motor car was waiting. The lieutenant thought he recognized Parkinson in the well-swathed form beside the driver, but there was no temptation to linger for a second on the steps. Already the stinging rain had lashed the drive into the semblance of a frothy estuary. All round the lightning jagged its course through the incessant, tremulent glow of more distant lightning, while the thunder only ceased its muttering to turn at close quarters and crackle viciously.
"One of the few things I regret missing," remarked Carados tranquilly. "But I hear a good deal of color in it."
The car slushed its way down to the gate, lurched a little heavily across the dip into the road, and, steadying as it came upon the straight, began to hum contentedly along the deserted highway.
"We are not going direct?"
suddenly inquired Hollier, after they had traveled perhaps half a dozen miles. The night was bewildering enough, but he had the sailor's gift for location.
"No, through Hunscott Green, and then by a field path to the orchard at the back," replied Carados. "Keep a sharp lookout for the man with the lantern about here, Harris," he called through the tube.
"Something flashing just ahead, sir," came the reply,
and the car slowed down and stopped. Carados dropped the near window as a man in glistening waterproof stepped from the shelter of a lich gate and approached.
"Inspector Beadle, sir,"
said the stranger, looking into the car. "Quite right, Inspector," said Carrados. "Get in."
"I have a man with me, sir."
"We can find room for him as well."
"We are very wet."
"So shall we all be soon."
The lieutenant changed his seat, and the two burly forms took places side by side. In less than 5 minutes, the car stopped again, this time in a grassy country lane.
"Now we have to face it," announced Carrados. "The inspector will show us the way."
The car slid round and disappeared into the night, while Beadle led the party to a stile in the hedge. A couple of fields brought them to the Brookbend boundary. There a figure stood out of the black foliage, exchanged a few words with their guide, and piloted them along the shadows of the orchard to the back door of the house.
"You will find a broken pane near the catch of the scullery window," said the blind man.
"Right, sir," replied the inspector. "I have it. Now, who goes through?"
"Mr. Hollier will open the door for us. I'm afraid you must take off your boots and all wet things, Lieutenant. We cannot risk a single spot inside."
They waited until the back door opened. Then each one divested himself in a similar manner and passed into the kitchen, where the remains of a fire still burned. The man from the orchard gathered together the discarded garments and disappeared again. Carrados turned to the lieutenant.
"A rather delicate job for you now, Mr. Hollier. I want you to go up to your sister, wake her, and get her into another room with as little fuss as possible. Tell her as much as you think fit, and let her understand that her very life depends on absolute stillness when she is alone. Don't be unduly hurried, but not a glimmer of a light, please."
10 minutes passed by the measure of the battered old alarum on the dresser shelf before the young man returned.
"I've had rather a time of it," he reported with a nervous laugh. "But I think it will be all right now. She is in the spare room."
"Then we will take our places. You and Parkinson come with me to the bedroom. Inspector, you have your own arrangements. Mr. Carlyle will be with you." They dispersed silently about the house. Hollier glanced apprehensively at the door of the spare room as they passed it, but within was as quiet as the grave. Their room lay at the other end of the passage.
"You may as well take your place in the bed now, Hollier," directed Carrados when they were inside and the door closed. "Keep well down among the clothes. Creek has to get up on the balcony, you know, and he will probably peep through the window, but he dare come no farther. Then, when he begins to throw up stones, slip on this dressing gown of your sister's. I'll tell you what to do after."
The next 60 minutes drew out into the longest hour that the lieutenant had ever known. Occasionally he heard a whisper pass between the two men who stood behind the window curtains, but he could see nothing. Then Carrados threw a guarded remark in his direction.
"He is in the garden now."
Something scraped slightly against the outer wall. But the night was full of wilder sounds, and in the house the furniture and the boards creaked and sprung between the yawling of the wind among the chimneys, the rattle of the thunder, and the pelting of the rain. It was a time to quicken the steadiest pulse, and when the crucial moment came, when a pebble suddenly rang against the pane with a sound that the tense waiting magnified into a shivering crash, Hollier leapt from the bed on the instant.
"Easy, easy," warned Carrados feelingly. "We will wait for another knock."
He passed something across.
"Here is a rubber glove. I have cut the wire, but you had better put it on. Stand just for a moment at the window. Move the catch so that it can blow open a little, and drop immediately. Now."
Another stone had rattled against the glass.
For Hollyer to go through his part was the work merely of seconds, and with a few touches, Carados spread the dressing gown to more effective disguise about the extended form. But an unforeseen and, in the circumstances, rather horrible interval followed. For Creek, in accordance with some detail of his never-revealed plan, continued to shower missile after missile against the panes until even the unimpressionable Parkinson shivered. "The last act," whispered Carados, a moment after the throwing had ceased. "He has gone round to the back. Keep as you are. We take cover now." He pressed behind the arras of an extemporized wardrobe, and the spirit of emptiness and desolation seemed once more to reign over the lonely house. From half a dozen places of concealment, ears were straining to catch the first guiding sound. He moved very stealthily, burdened perhaps by some strange scruple in the presence of the tragedy that he had not feared to contrive. Paused for a moment at the bedroom door, then opened it very quietly, and in the fickle light read the consummation of his hopes. "At last," they heard the sharp whisper drawn from his relief. "At last." He took another step, and the two shadows seemed to fall upon him from behind, one on either side. With primitive instinct, a cry of terror and surprise escaped him as he made a desperate movement to wrench himself free, and for a short second he almost succeeded in dragging one hand into a pocket. Then his wrists slowly came together, and the handcuffs closed. "I am Inspector Beadle," said the man on his right side. "You are charged with the attempted murder of your wife, Millicent Creek." "You are mad," retorted the miserable creature, falling into a desperate calmness. "She has been struck by lightning." "No, you blackguard, she hasn't," wrathfully exclaimed his brother-in-law, jumping up. "Would you like to see her?"
"I also have to warn you," continued the inspector impassively, "that anything you say may be used as evidence against you."
A startled cry from the farther end of the passage arrested their attention. "Mr. Carados," called Hollyer. "Oh, come at once." At the open door of the other bedroom stood the lieutenant, his eyes still turned towards something in the room beyond, a little empty bottle in his hand.
"Dead," he exclaimed tragically, with a sob, "with this beside her. Dead, just when she would have been free of the brute."
The blind man passed into the room, sniffed the air, and laid a gentle hand on the pulseless heart. "Yes," he replied. "That, Hollyer, does not always appeal to the woman, strange to say."
The End.